Today on Vox Talks Economics, spatial disparities in Europe. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips, and every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram as well. This summer, Vox Talks is on tour. It's bringing you live interviews from CPR's Paris Symposium. Now, inequality is a focus of many of the panels and keynotes here. And that's inequality not just between individuals, but between regions as well. Henry Overman of London School of Economics is part of a panel that's been discussing spatial disparities in Europe and what can be done about them. And he joins me now. Henry, welcome.
Pleasure to be here on a lovely sunny day in Paris.
And we're indoors. Henry, I'm from the north of England originally. I don't sound like it. But policymakers have been talking about the north-south divide for as long as I can remember, since I was a kid. We've been worrying about this problem for decades. Is it getting any better?
I think that depends. So then let's start with the classic economist caveat. On some measures, I think it's getting slightly better. So let's focus on the UK, as you started there, and that's the place I know best. So if you think about labour market disparities, so earnings, which, you know, ultimately is the major source of income for the vast majority of people, the gaps between the richest and the poorest places have narrowed slightly over the last 20 years. So, you know, that's the good news. But that fall is modest, and those gaps increased hugely in the period before as the country deindustrialized.
Yeah.
So I think the progress has been modest, but the initial gaps were very large. The other thing that I would say, which I think really matters here, is that there I was talking about the overall level of disparities, but you can also think about where individual places are, and places are stuck. If you take where place was in the 1980s, 1990s, you know, relative to the UK average, and you then look at where it would be, say, 2020 or pre-COVID, let's say, as we're sort of talking about long-run disparities, you would just be in the same position. You know, so London was doing pretty well, is now doing very well. Somewhere towards the bottom of the par would be doing badly in the early parts of the period and would still be doing badly later. So I think that it's the level, the size of the disparities are big, the trends are favourable but moderate relative to the size, and places are stuck.
It is a big policy focus in the UK at the moment. We have this levelling up agenda. For our non-British listeners, could you explain what that is?
Not really. Now, that's a terribly facetious answer. It's difficult from an economist's perspective to be precise about what the government is aiming for in terms of levelling up. In some broad sense, it is trying to make sure that places that aren't doing well do better.
Okay.
But the devil is in the details. So what's not really clear to those of us who follow this is this about the economics? Well, they've got 12 missions, and mission one is about the economics. So that's levelling up wages and pay, etc. So that's important. But it could also be about, you know, public good provision. They have other missions that are about what we're going to do in terms of education. Or it could be about amenities and how people are feeling about their high street. So they have, you know, another set of missions which are around crime or sorting out dilapidated town centres. There's 12 of these missions in all. It's hard to disagree with any of them. But ultimately, they'll have to make decisions about where they're going to spend the money. And I think that's why I gave that initial glib answer that it's a little bit hard to say, because depending on who's speaking on what day, they'll emphasize different aspects of the mission. And I think economists tend to get nervous when the objectives are very, very broad. Because it becomes very hard to think about, A, whether you've achieved them, or B, how you would achieve them.
Is it typical of the sort of policy initiatives that are being used in advanced economies, or is it out on its own?
Oh, it's certainly not out on its own. I worry that the sense in which it might be unique is the ratio of emphasis from the politicians,
mm.
in contrast to the amount of money that they are spending.
Right.
Everywhere has this. So we're in Paris. There is a cohesion policy which covers the whole of Europe, which is about trying to narrow those disparities. The UK has left the European Union, and so we're introducing the UK Shared Prosperity Fund to replace that. What's the big, big political argument at the moment is about whether the level of expenditure that we have in the UK Shared Prosperity Fund will anywhere near match the allocation of funds that came to us through cohesion fund policy.
Yeah.
So I think we're unusual in perhaps the extent of the rhetoric and the emphasis that's being placed on it and how central the political narrative is. I think that we are not unusual in caring about it, and we may well be spending less than is being spent in many comparator countries.
I guess if we're going to do anything about spatial disparities, we really have to understand as well as we can why they exist. Is the fundamental problem here that the skilled, the high-paying jobs tend to exist in some regions and not in others?
I think that's a big part of the story. If we think about what explains those spatial disparities that we see, and this story goes far more broadly than the UK, we know that graduates and the higher skilled more than the low-skilled or non-graduates, and we know that those graduates are very highly spatially concentrated. So in the UK, the extremes are 15% of adults will have a degree in Doncaster, 55% of adults would have a degree in Brighton. If you take the people that earn a lot and put them all in one place, then of course, you know, that place is going to earn more than other places. Now, the geography does complicate that because, of course, there is also a role for places in this, and some places, you know, are more productive and pay higher wages.
Mm-hmm.
Those high-skilled workers are also concentrated in the most productive places. So the forces of economic geography take the spatial disparities that exist at the individual level between mm-hmm. high and low-skilled and magnify them further so that they are larger than they otherwise would have been. That's how it plays out. Of course, there's then a question as to why we end up with those patterns, and that takes us into a discussion about the causes of, mm-hmm. of those patterns that we see.
But it is made worse because those 50% in Doncaster are looking around and thinking, I could maybe do better for myself if I move somewhere else.
You're going there onto the supply side. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about the supply of graduates. There, I tend to emphasize two things. One, there is selective migration. Right. If you are in the 15% of people in Doncaster who get a degree, then you're looking around for opportunities and you're thinking, actually, Doncaster can't offer many opportunities to me. So if I move to London or Manchester or whatever, the set of opportunities is going to be much broader. One part of the story is that sort of selective migration, mm-hmm. out migration. I mean, it's always happened. Actually,
yeah.
If you talk to people in these places, which we've been doing recently in some lived experience work that we've been doing as part of a large project, you see they're quite accepting of the fact that their young kids probably do need to think about moving out for those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said that's one part of the story. And by the way, I'm not just picking on Doncaster here. You know, that is a story that happens systematically across the board. The other part of the story, of course, is that once you get these effects persisting over long periods of time, you start to worry about what's happening between generations. And one of the things we know from the education economics literature is that there is a lot of intergenerational transmission. If your parents have a degree, you're more likely to get a degree. If your parents don't have a degree, you're less likely to get a degree. We probably put quite a lot of weight on that selective migration story. I actually think we need to be careful not to lose sight of the fact that a lot of this is just that if you're born in one of those poorer places, you're less likely to get a degree because of your family circumstances and, of course, the wider circumstances as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a two-part story for me when you're looking at the sort of supply side of graduates. Selective migration and that intergenerational transmission and how kids do in the education system.
All right, let's talk about what works then. I know that a few years ago, you were one of the authors of a paper on regional selective assistance in the European Union, and that was pretty positive about the impact that had, giving subsidies to firms in those left behind places to create employment. Are these policies, generally speaking, bringing down spatial inequality?
I mean, there the detail matters a lot. Mm. So if you take regional selective assistance, what we found there, which was a capital subsidy, you know, that was targeted at firms in deprived areas, we found that it could increase employment, but it didn't do very much for productivity. Mm-hmm. So why am I making that distinction? Well, that says that we can use policies like regional selective assistance to shuffle around the employment to places that are struggling, but those firms are going to struggle long run, mm-hmm. right? If we don't fix the productivity gaps. If you look at the history of those kind of subsidies, we often end up paying them again and again and again. So, yeah. you know, you say yeah. from the UK, you know, that'll be the argument that you see around Nissan. You know, Nissan is a large car production plant in the northeast, poor area. Mm-hmm. I assume it receives regional selective assistance. We are constantly worried that it'll go. I think that's one thing to be careful on there. They might ameliorate the problem, but they don't necessarily solve it. The second thing I would say is lots of those policies don't necessarily work, so you've got to construct them carefully. The British government at the moment is very exercised by free ports and similarly by enterprise zones. The evidence much less good on those because the nature, at least in a UK context, because the nature of those policies is that we worry that they tend to just attract firms from nearby areas. You get a lot of displacement across the zone boundary. If you're trying to gentrify or regenerate a small part of a city, you can get that to work in your favour. But if what you're trying to do is, you know, pull up the performance of Newcastle or the Northeast as a whole, mm-hmm. shuffling the stuff around within Newcastle, it's not going to get you very far. I think the other problem with those kind of policies is that ultimately they're not really scalable.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about the market forces that are driving spatial disparities, it is that high-skilled workers and the firms that employ them get pulled into big places, and then that effect becomes cumulative. If you're a firm that needs to employ high-skilled workers, you go where those high-skilled workers are. If you're a high-skilled worker who wants to have a job, you need to go where those firms are. That's the example that we were talking about just now. And things like regional selective assistance, they just can't offset those strong market forces. You need another set of policy instruments to do that.
A couple of times you've mentioned the phrase shuffling around, and that's kind of interesting because we think about it in terms of here are a certain set of high-skilled workers and we put them into different places, and that brings down these spatial disparities. Should we maybe be focusing more on creating high-skilled workers in other places?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. I think it's a really important distinction, so let me come at it in two ways. So I think the first part is sort of almost picking up where we just left off, which is what would the effective set of policy interventions be to, say, rebalance a country like the UK? Or coming here in France, you've got the same problem yes. with Paris being a yep. massive outlier relative to lots of the other metro areas. If you're going to offset those kind of large-scale spatial disparities, you've got to think about getting those cumulative market forces operating somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So in the panel session that we've just had, we talked a little bit about that. And we said, well, look, you know, actually, what would you do? You probably pick somewhere, again, I'll use the UK-specific example, like Manchester, you know, a poorer city in the northwest, or Newcastle, poorer city in the northeast, and you really go for it. Infrastructure investment, public sector relocation, R&D investment, etc. Now, why are you really going for it? You're really going for it because you're trying to start to kickstart those market forces. This is where we come to your question. If you don't do anything else, that's just around about shuffling around the high-skilled workers and trying to drive up the average income in Manchester by getting more graduates to live there. You then have to ask yourself, well, does that benefit the poorer people yes. who live in Manchester, yes. which seems pretty important? And there, I think it's terribly worrying because, you know, what do we know about London? We know that London has one of the highest poverty rates in the UK mm-hmm. because it's incredibly expensive to live in. And there, I think we come to the set of policy prescriptions that we were talking about. If we want that process to work for people towards the bottom end of the labour market, we've got to think about what we do to enable them to access the opportunities that we're generating. So if we go to Manchester, generate a whole bunch of jobs there, how do we make sure that poorer people in Manchester can benefit from that? Now, that access to opportunity is often taken as being rather narrowly about improving buses or improving high-speed rail or whatever. I think that's a little bit of a red herring. It can matter a lot, but Barking and Dagenham, which is a poorer area in the east end of London that is a 20-minute commute dispute from the largest employment concentration in Europe points to the limits of fixing transport and everything else coming right for these people who struggle. So I think you've got to do things that say, okay, we need to intervene early in improving primary and secondary education outcomes. So that's younger and older pupils. And then we've got to think about tackling the other barriers to labour market participation that these poorer families face. So that is things like, what are we going to do about childcare? If you're poorer, you tend to rely on informal childcare networks rather than formal childcare networks. So how do we fix that for people? How do we deal with the physical and mental health problems that we know are concentrated particularly strongly on people who are poorer and that represent a major barrier to work? So there's a whole sort of set of supporting policies that you would have to do to make sure that people could access these opportunities. It goes beyond just education. The final point I would make on that is I think the graduate thing is important, but we've had a policy of ramping up graduate rates. I actually think it's really important that we think about vocational education and the kind of education that is provided by further education colleges in the UK. And it's really there that I think we fall a long way short of some of our international comparators.
A lot of the things you're talking about here, Henry, they are long-term fixes and they tend to outlast governments or particular policy initiatives. One of the good news stories you often hear reported from COVID-19, one of not very many, is that perhaps this new focus on remote working gives more opportunities for people to get good jobs without having to live in the place, the expensive place where the good jobs are. And this might be a force across Europe to bring down spatial disparities. Is this a credible story?
Not really, I think is my essential. So look, I think it could help. We will get lots of good news stories in the newspapers about people living in remote areas that now commute into some trendy job. Ultimately, we've just talked about the major barriers to people at the bottom of the labour market face to, you know, in accessing opportunities. I just don't think it helps very much. I think the second problem with it is that I think 100% remote working is not really where we're heading for the vast majority of people.
Yep.
You know, we're probably heading towards 3 days in 5 in the office. And 3 days in 5 means you've got to get there. And if anything, I think maybe that could end up privileging the places like Paris and London, which already have large commuter sheds and could cope with the commuter sheds being even larger. Could well be that some of those more peripheral cities, which used to be a place that you went for to get cheap offices, etc., that they're no longer so attractive. So I think that you could certainly overstate it by looking at these individual stories. I think that it's going to be much more nuanced of a large spatial scale. The other thing that I would say, and this really does depend on the country that you're in, if you read something that talks about large population shifts, and you are in a country like the UK, which net builds tens of thousands of houses a year, no more, that cannot happen. The only thing that can happen is that the demographics of different places change. And then we're right back to the story about who benefits from that. We're going to see lots of people priced out of their nice rural area, which didn't used to be a place you could work from, because now actually the trendy person with that trendy job that they really can remote work from thinks that living in a small rural village would be quite a good thing. I don't think it's going to be a panacea. I think it's going to be very complicated. Overall, I should say, and the OECD has some really good stuff on this, I think it could be really beneficial for workers. But I think the main policy things are going to be making sure that we do things like right to disconnect. Who's going to deal with health and safety issues between work environments? Who's going to deal with the childcare? Making sure people aren't always on. I think that is the route for delivering much larger benefits than thinking about the fact that, oh, maybe this time, this particular drop in information and communication costs will suddenly benefit the rural areas, when the drops that we've been seeing for the last 30 years haven't.
There's no easy answers, are there, Henry? What happens if we do not solve these problems?
There are no easy answers. I think we've got to try to solve them. I was asked just now, should we care about these things? We should care about them. I think we should care about them from the economics. But the answer I gave in the panel session that we just had here in Paris was that I worry about them because of Brexit, Trump and Le Pen. The politics of this are very, very problematic. And I think that we need to do something to help address the fact that people in many places feel that they are being left behind by the way that the global economy is changing. I'll caveat that a little bit. I think often these things aren't anything to do with spatial policy. They're the spatial manifestation of big global trends that apply as much in the suburbs of Paris as they do in the sort of poor areas of Manchester. But I think we've got to do something about them. And I think that politicians are right to focus on it.
Well, as we say, we've had quite a lot of political focus, certainly in the UK, on this. Let's see what comes out of it. Henry, thanks for talking about it today.
Pleasure.
If you want to look into more of this, then CEPR has Research Policy Network on Spatial Disparities and Policy. You're part of that, aren't you, Henry?
I am, yep.
Well, then there'll be good stuff coming out of it, I'm sure. The OECD, as Henry pointed out as well, has a topic on regional, rural and urban development with a lot of research for you there if you look it up. This has been a Vox Talk recorded live at the CPR Paris Symposium 2022. Every week we bring you the most important latest research, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe, you'll find more than 200 episodes now. So whatever type of economics you like, there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.